I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Brad Cran joins me in person, in studio, if you will. He's just published his second book of poetry, Ink on Paper. It's a highly readable, thoughtful, and stimulating collection of poems. They deal with the area, Vancouver, Canada, and beyond. Some are political, some are personal, and some are both. It's been a fascinating read, as the poems herein are contemporary, provocative, and keenly aware of this time and place, popular culture, and beyond. I'll get Mr. Cran to tell us about the book, about the poetry he commits, and how poetry is perceived by the general audience. Are our schools teaching poetry well? How savvy do readers have to be? What's revealed in this book about the author, the poet, the citizen? Brad Cran is a writer and social entrepreneur who was the poet laureate for the City of Vancouver from 2009 to 2011. His first book of nonfiction, written with Gillian Jerome, was the prize-winning Hope in Shadows, Stories and Photographs of Vancouver's Downtown East Side. His last book of poetry was The Good Life. He's currently working on a second book of nonfiction. He's also the driving force behind Echo Tax File. I'm a client, and it's a terrific business. BradCran.com is the website for more. Ink on Paper is published by Knightwood Editions. This Saturday, the 13th of April, 2013, at the Western Front, 303 East 8th Avenue, there'll be a launch of this book, as well as Elizabeth Bashinsky's The Hottest Summer in Recorded History and Timely Irreverence by Jay Miller. That's at 8:15 p.m. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Brad Cran. Mr. Cran, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. When you put a collection of poems together, like you have in Ink on Paper, I guess the first question is, this is the kind of poetry that you write all the time, is it?
It is. This was a strange book for me in that my last book was 11 years ago, and I really took a long time. So for me, really, what this is sort of 11 years worth of thinking, kind of spread out, and it's a much slower book than my last book, which in my early 20s, like, you know, I had to get out as quick as I can. I think I took the exact opposite approach with this.
And so the theme in which you these poems are in, how do you decide that these are the poems that are going to be in this collection? Or is there a lot of thinking that goes on, or is it just recent stuff that you've done and you put together?
I think with this collection, it's just a really personal collection. I wanted something that sort of represented sort of my life and thinking around poetry. And a major thing for me was being appointed the Poet Laureate for a couple of years for the City of Vancouver. And what that sort of did is it gave me an audience that doesn't usually read poetry. And that was an important shift for me as well, is just getting back to the more lyrical narrative sort of poems that really first got me excited about poetry in the first place.
And how much of what's in this collection can be read for insight as to who you are, as to what your thinking is? I mean, I've known you for a couple of years, but I don't know you that well. And so I sort of picked up the book thinking, well, maybe this is my chance to get to know Brad and what's going on in his head. I mean, is that an appropriate way to approach the book?
Unfortunately for me, it is, because the weird, strange thing about this sort of odd thing we do with poetry is that, you know, it's very much putting myself out there. There's a couple poems in there which I have a hard time even reading because they're so personal to me. And, you know, you do it and you're sort of walking down the street getting your groceries or something, you bump into someone who might have read your book, and all of a sudden you're confronted with the idea that this person actually knows your deepest, darkest confessions or whatnot. So it can be a little awkward. But yeah, I think this book, for me, the reason I'm happy with it is not on an ambitious level, but because I do think it just actually represents who I am, and it's the book that I wanted to write.
Do you write poetry because you want to say something that you wouldn't say otherwise? Like, I mean, you could easily write an op-ed in a newspaper, you could blog, you could tweet. So do you write poetry to express yourself, essentially? I mean, is that the goal when you're putting pen to paper or when you're typing?
I think it is sort of to express myself to myself, especially in these poems, which is that it's not always necessarily something where I'm thinking, oh, I can't wait to share this. It's actually part of the process of thinking. For me, you know, my whole life's sort of been defined by poetry. It's the sort of first success I've ever had in my life was poetry. I think it's how I taught myself or learned how to critical think. And so for me, yeah, it's a more personal approach, and then at the end, you know, after the year, you kind of pick through the ones you think you might want to share, and kind of move from there and see how it kind of builds into a collection.
Is it a catharsis for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think just with the craziness of raising two kids, of working, of doing all that, that it's actually sort of a meditative way to kind of slow my mind and get back to make sure the old noggin's still working all right.
And is the process for you a solitary one?
Undoubtedly, yeah.
Yeah,
without question. Solitary to actually do it. And, you know, even at the end of it, it's not something that I'm always just sort of like, you know, burning to share. It is more of a personal sort of journey for the most part. And if, you know, you have things that people can relate to, then it works well.
And can you write poetry, say, with a busy house with two kids, or even if you're in a coffee shop, say, and it's bustling there?
Well, I'm bad with that. But like the one thing, like I know, was it Raymond Carver? One of the reasons he liked to write poetry was because he could just sneak away and go sit in his car and do it without his typewriter, where he needed to do fiction. And I think there's something about that. You can steal away a few minutes here and there. But for me, those minutes should hopefully be quiet and away from the hustle and bustle of domestic life.
We haven't talked about the book yet, but you'll indulge me in talking about the process, because I find it fascinating. You've written nonfiction. Is it a different sort of process?
Completely. Yeah, I think. Well, actually, you know what? It is. At the same time, this book is very much informed by nonfiction. And nonfiction is something I love exploring nonfiction. I love research. You know, I've told a few people, oh, yeah, I'm researching a poem right now. You know, I can't do that. And they're like, wow, you research poetry. Yeah. Like most people don't. They think of it as more of a confessional thing. But a lot of, I'd say at least, you know, half the book is sort of based in research and storytelling. And taking those stories and sort of trying to understand how they reflect on the ideas I have.
The other thing, when I picked up the book, it didn't. Some of the poems didn't seem to me, in reading them, like they were poetry.
Yeah.
It seemed like an essay that you were writing, and the punctuation was off. I mean, does it annoy you when you have to sort of explain to people what poetry is, and encounter readers like me who aren't savvy as to what poetry is?
Well, I think there's not a whole lot of examples out there of books quite like that that do kind of mix in the essay form with poetry.
Yeah.
And for me, it was one of those things where I just felt like, you know what, I've been going in this direction so long, I'm going to go in the other direction and see where it takes me. And what happens if you do inject large pieces of essayistic writing into a poem? It affects the poem, so it has a purpose. It has an effect, and for me, it was less trying to prove my poetic skill in every line, and just allowing the poem to have some breathing room, to just have confidence in that, and if need be, just concentrate on even one poetic moment.
The longest piece in the book is the poem that shares the title of the book, Ink on Paper.
Yeah.
And that's about this guy, Gu Sheng, is it?
Yeah, Gu Sheng.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought of when I talked about the book, some of the pieces in the book seeming like an essay, because that's, as I said, a long piece, and it seems like an essay about this guy. Where do you decide to break the line? Because it's written almost in paragraphs.
Yeah.
Is that an aesthetic thing, just because it looks on the page better? Is that
for the most part, on those essay ones, the line breaks aren't as manicured as they are in the more traditional poems.
Yeah.
But the thing with that is that you'll find little bits of poetry and tighter little nuggets of poetry within in that piece. And really, the reason that story interests me, because that writer in particular, I think, represents a lot of the things that I don't necessarily like about writers, and it gave me an in to sort of discuss that and place some of those thoughts down.
There are some beautiful lines in that, and I'm looking through my notes here frantically trying to find some, but I can't really read my writing. So, but it is, I mean, that's a very interesting piece about an interesting person and an interesting time. And you reveal yourself, I think, in it as to the relationship that you have to your work, to your writing, as well as the relationship that people have, the writers have with other writers. I think it's in that poem that there's a line about you were at a dinner and you were with someone from the downtown east side, and then a fellow writer comes by to the table and then sorts of, it's an awards dinner, and trashes all the people that won the awards. Mm-hmm. And your companion turns to you and says, doesn't he realize, this writer, how lucky he is that people listen to him? I think that's in the Goucher
poem. Yeah, that is.
Did you think about that? I mean, in terms of whatever impact you have on the reader, and how that you are listened to, that you are read.
It's something I think about all the time. And that awards dinner was actually the awards, the BC Book Prize awards dinner for Hope and Shadows, and we were at the table with 12 people from the downtown east side who, you know. Being in print was one of the most highest honors that they'd actually ever had, and they really appreciated it, and it put a lot of my ambitions in check for me. I just thought, here's people. The comment after that, I'm not sure if that this is in the book. I don't think it is, but the woman who said that, she said, we were talking about it afterwards, and she said, look, I come from a community where the women in the community couldn't convince the police that we were being murdered. Mm-hmm. And, it puts it in check, like, who cares about a literary award so much if you understand the amount of privilege that you have. And it's not that I think you should feel guilty for that privilege, but I think that we should appreciate it when we have it and use it wisely.
Yeah, and do people write you? I mean, what's that like? I mean, when they read something that you've written, and then they, I mean, because of social media and the internet now, I mean, it's easier to contact writers, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Did you get feedback from them?
The weirdest thing happened, which is I got I'm not sure if you know the musician Jonathan Richman. But he's someone who we listened to all through Hope and Shadows. He was just his music's music I love. And 2 years after the book came out, we got a fan letter from him, which was really nice.
Yeah.
So, occasionally you get a note. I like those notes. I think for me they mean just as much or more than a review or more than an award.
In the book, you seem to have a dim view or a skeptical view of the right, the religious right. Sort of neoconservative thinking in Canada and in the United States today.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Is that because you're on the opposite side of the political spectrum, or is it because you just don't understand where they're coming from? People like Sarah Palin or...
Oh, well, see, I have a hard time with... And there's a poem in the book for Palin, but I don't consider her so much as a legitimate political figure, and when you say skeptical of the right, I'm equally as skeptical of the far left.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking a little bit about this earlier, but I have a high disregard for any of the sort of extremist non-thinking things, and I try to come at it with a critical mind. And in the States, it's particularly hard because I think you have a whole political system basically being shut down, where a very narrow margin of people are actually making the decisions, the swing voters and things. But yeah, I think I would try to be equally critical on both sides. But Palin's one who I think is ripe for comedy.
Yeah, and I, even though I tend to vote right wing, I would agree with you. There's a couple of the pieces in the book, I think more than a couple, were written in reaction to something you've read.
Yes.
And I mentioned, I'll mention John Ibbotson just because he was on here recently with his latest book. how does that happen in terms of the process? I mean, you're reading the Globe and Mail that day, you see an Ibbotson column, and it provokes you to write something. I mean, does that happen all the time with you?
You know, I just, for me, I wanted to write about the process of reading and the things where I've read that, where I've actually read something, because reading is actually a really big part of my life, and it's something that people actually don't really write a lot about, but yeah. It actually is probably one of the most common, inspirations for writers. Like, that's what we do. You know, if you want to start writing, the first thing you do is pick up a book and start reading. And for me, once I kind of had some of those poems down, then I think I went out and searched out a few others. And the Ibbotson one, I was actually commissioned by the Globe and Mail to write a poem to end my time as poet laureate, and went through the paper and found that piece and worked from there.
Yeah, his new book is a pretty good read, but after reading that and then reading your poem, you do see a pattern in terms of the thinking that, I don't know if he espouses it himself, he probably does, but people of his ilk or people that subscribe to his sort of view on the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you've done in this book, and some of the pieces is reflect sort of, I don't know, culturally held, politically held ideas or sort of broad ideas of how government should function or so on. Well, what's the problem with Tamara Taggart?
Oh, no. Poor old Tamara Taggart. There's a poem in there about her.
About her hair, right? The back of her head? Or?
Yeah, the poem's about being so excited to be seeing the back of her head. It actually comes from all the people who are jumping up behind her at the Olympics. And I think the Olympics, I think, deserved a little bit of critiquing, because I think at the time everyone just wanted to say how great it was, which doesn't mean that, you know, it didn't have its great moments. But
and you did some of that during the Olympics, if I remember, right?
Yeah. There was a little incident with myself and the Olympic Vanock.
Yeah.
Where I declined to participate based on a couple things that they decided to do, including instigate a muzzle clause against people who had been participating or wanted to participate in the Olympics.
And you write about that in this book. I mean, there's the piece on the, I can't remember the sport that they were in, where they were banned.
The female ski jumpers. And that was actually they were asking me to sign a little muzzle clause that would basically say you can't critique any level of government. But at the same time, I already clearly had and continued to by supporting the 14 female ski jumpers who were suing Vanock to be included in the Olympic Games.
So that piece is in this book, that poem. There are other things that allude to the Olympics in this book. Do you look at the time? I mean, we're about 3 years past it. I'm assuming that your views haven't changed as to the spectacle of it. What has distance and time done for you view the Olympics?
One thing with that is that I think a lot of people are assuming that I was sort of anti-Olympics, yeah. which actually wasn't the case. And in fact, I was actually trying to orchestrate and get poets onto the stages of the Olympics. And when things sort of broke down there, and there was a couple other, I think things were just moving a little too full steam ahead with certain visions. And I think one of the things is asking Vancouver artists to sign a muzzle clause so they won't critique the government was just not only absurd, but also it goes against the whole historical nature of what Vancouver is. And when I made that statement, I got this surprise defender in the media who was the artistic director of the Salt Lake City Olympics, and he said, look, this is absolute crap. And he said, you know you're in trouble if Salt Lake City's telling Vancouver to lighten up. And, that was a nice thing. But, you know, I don't think had things worked out differently, I would have been involved in the Olympics. But there were, I think, some mistakes that were being made on the organizing level that I just thought someone should speak up against.
And whatever criticism you had or have was not a reflection on some of the poets that were participating, and I think you make that clear in one of the pieces in the book. I think Shane Coyson, I think that's a guy.
You know, as soon as that happened, people wanted to pit me against Shane. Yeah. I hadn't really met Shane. We met around that because I instantly came out and just said, no, that's not what it is. Like, Shane made his decision and I made mine, and you know, I could have made the same decision and was trying to make the same decision. Not for myself, but to get other poets on the stage. So it kind of takes a life of its own. Like, when I first, the essay, Why I Declined to Participate in Olympic Games, I thought, okay, if the Georgia Strait picks it up by the end of the day, that'll be my barometer for success. Well, by the end of the week, I'd done New York Times, BBC, CBC Toronto, you know, kind of flew off the handle, because I think there were so many media outlets in Vancouver with absolutely nothing to write about, so... there I was. But as soon as the game started, it was old news.
I mentioned in the introduction, the last time you were on, we talked about poetry and how it's read. In terms of how it's taught, do you think schools are doing a good job?
Well, I hate to say this, but I don't want to. I think probably not. And I think some of the... the people who are teaching, I think they really should, and that's great. But one of the things, because we had a program of going in and teaching poetry to the poetry in the schools, and I think a lot of teachers are still marking poetry and grading it, which even the idea of marking and grading it sounds insane to me. Mm-hmm. But some of the best, I think, kids with the brightest ideas and things might have been dealt with the harshest in some of the instances. And, you know, we had one teacher who was marking haiku like it was a math equation, yeah, right? Like, yeah, counting the syllables and marking the kid down. And, you know, we would come in and try and change that and say, look, no, forget about all that. Just, like, let's just talk about the creativity. Like, you know, you have your math, you have your thing. Don't just put all that aside. They can be marked in that now. Let's just see if we can get some really interesting ideas out of these kids.
See, I graduated high school in 2000, and... one of the reasons why I've come to poetry late in life, I guess, and still I don't think I grasp it. I don't think I grasp it, is because I think what you're talking about, that's the way that I was taught it in elementary school and high school.
Yeah.
And so how do you change it? I guess you got to get away from marking it, right?
I think that we had this one teacher I just thought was the most amazing teacher, and she said the thing, she came to us and said, you know what? I have no idea about this. Can you? And she actually went through and, you know, said, "Here, like, show me. How does it work?" And we had this one, and this is in the book. But the kid who, and she had marked him down. But everyone asked for a wish. I wish. I wish. And mm-hmm. you know, she marked the kids that she all marked high. She said, "Okay, I'm going to mark them, and then you sort of rank the ones that you find interesting, and we'll put them together." And we found that the ones that she found more interesting were the kids that did the best in her class and that were the most eager to talk and enunciated and had all this sort of thing. And then we had this kid, you could barely read his writing, but all the kids like, I wish I was a princess, I wish I was a firefighter. And this kid said, I wish I saw a red cow in a dictionary. And it was just the most perfect thing to hear, because it's odd and it's weird, and that's where poetry comes from. Like, how do you take this thing that everyone's sort of thinking about it in this way, and how do you turn it on its head? And I think with her, she was an amazing teacher, because she just said, you know what? I don't understand this. Teach me how to do it. How do we break out of this mold? And once she did, her students were flying.
So what's bad poetry then? Or is there anything like that?
Yeah, well, for me, there is. I think for a lot of poets, there is. I think the more you read, the higher... the more you might not like. But it really just comes to, you know, whatever your thing is. Like, you know, you can have one book that half the country is going to love, and then the other half might hate it.
What's the relationship with the other two authors that you'll be speaking with on Saturday at Western Front at 8:15?
By coincidence, the reason this worked out is we just all happen to be friends, but basically it's just that our publishers, you come out on a line, so this is the spring lineup, and the three of us happen to know each other, so we thought we'd launch together in Vancouver and Toronto.
I read Elizabeth's book, and your wife's mentioned in there. So is it a close-knit community?
Yeah, I think so. She happens to be a close friend of ours, but it is a close community. Yeah, you get to know everyone pretty quickly.
Yeah. It's been fun talking again, it's been fun reading this book. As you know, I don't read poetry often, but I found it interesting because you have a point of view that's interesting. That's well read. That knows stuff, if you will. But it was also a great chance to get to know you, I guess. And so, congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The website for bradcran.com. The event is this Saturday at 8:15 at Western Front, 303 East 8th Avenue. Knightwoodeditions.com is the website for information on the book and the event. Ink on Paper is published by Knightwood Editions. Brad Cran joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.